Detroit, 1975. A man waits in a parking lot for a meeting that was never meant to happen. Within minutes, he vanishes. No witnesses, no struggle, no trace. I'm not here to spin theories. I'm here to lay out what we know. Every confirmed sighting, every declassified document, every name the FBI buried beneath red tape and silence. Jimmy Hoffa was more than a union boss. He was power, raw, dangerous, and unfiltered. And when that power threatened the wrong people, he disappeared. In this investigation, we retrace Hoffa's final day, expose his ties to the mafia, and reveal the political deals that may have sealed his fate. No dramatization, no fiction, just the truth, layer by brutal layer. This is the story of manipulation, betrayal, and silence. This is the true crime behind Hoffa's last ride. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, The Vanishing Point. July 30th, 1975. Bloomfield Township, Michigan. It was a humid Wednesday afternoon, somewhere around 2:15 p.m., when James Riddle Hoffa, one of the most powerful labor leaders in American history, was last seen alive. He was standing in the parking lot of the Machu's Red Fox, a quiet, upscale restaurant located at the corner of Telegraph and Maple Roads, just outside Detroit. Hoffa had told his wife he was going there for a meeting. He was supposed to be back by 4 o'clock. He never returned. At first glance, the scene was ordinary. A restaurant, a few parked cars, a man in a navy suit, standing near his maroon Pontiac Grandville. But what happened next has puzzled investigators, haunted union members, and fueled conspiracy theorists for nearly half a century. Hoffa had scheduled a lunch meeting with two men he knew well, Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, a feared mobster from New Jersey with deep ties to the Genovese crime family, and Anthony Giacalone, a Detroit-based mafia figure. According to Hoffa's family and close associates, the purpose of the meeting was to clear the air. Hoffa wanted to regain control of the Teamsters after his prison sentence, something the mafia had no interest in supporting. He was spotted standing outside the restaurant by multiple credible witnesses between 2:15 and 2:45 p.m. One witness, a truck driver waiting in the lot, told the FBI he saw Hoffa pacing, checking his watch repeatedly. He appeared irritated, like he'd been stood up. Another said Hoffa spoke briefly with someone in a car before getting into the vehicle and being driven away. That was the last confirmed sighting. His car, the maroon Grandville, was found later that night in the same parking lot. Locked. Untouched. There were no signs of struggle. No blood. No broken glass. No disturbance at all. It was as if he had simply vanished. His wife, Josephine Hoffa, reported him missing by 7 p.m. She knew something was wrong immediately. He was punctual, even obsessive about his schedule. For him to miss dinner, miss his evening calls, it wasn't just odd. It was unthinkable. The police response was slow at first. This was, after all, Jimmy Hoffa. He had enemies. He had power. He had a reputation for disappearing temporarily when he wanted to make a point. But by the next day, it was clear this wasn't a bluff. The FBI would launch one of the largest manhunts in its history. Within 48 hours, they were issuing subpoenas, conducting interviews, and tapping phones. By the end of the first week, they had already formed a working theory. Hoffa had been lured to the restaurant under false pretenses, picked up by someone he trusted, and murdered within hours, possibly within minutes, of getting into that car. But without a body, they had nothing. Investigators interviewed over 200 people. They followed leads from Michigan to New Jersey, to Florida, and back again. But every promising thread dissolved into silence. No confession. No confirmed witness. No trace of a body. The press exploded. Theories ran wild. Some said he was buried beneath Giant Stadium in New Jersey. Others claimed he was incinerated in a mob-controlled Detroit garbage facility. A few insisted he was buried in the foundation of the Renaissance Center, the then-under-construction skyscraper on Detroit's waterfront. But none of it was provable. None of it was physical. No fingerprints. No DNA. No weapon. No vehicle linked to his abduction. Just silence, strategic, deliberate silence from a criminal network bound by Omerta, the mafia code of silence. To understand how Jimmy Hoffa could disappear in broad daylight, in a public space, without a single confirmed witness, we must understand not only who Hoffa was, but who wanted him gone. And why? because by 1975, Jimmy Hoffa wasn't just a labor leader. He was a threat to the mafia's control of the Teamsters, to political figures who had quietly enabled him, and to the reputation of a country still reeling from the Watergate scandal. Chapter 2, The Power Broker. Before we can understand the magnitude of Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance, we have to understand the magnitude of his presence. By the early 1950s, Hoffa had already risen through the ranks of the Teamsters Union, a labor organization that represented truck drivers, warehouse workers, and freight haulers across the country. At its peak, the Teamsters had over 2.3 million members and represented one of the most powerful labor forces in American history. But Hoffa didn't just organize labor. He weaponized it. He understood that if you controlled the trucks, you controlled the economy. Food, fuel, construction, medicine, everything moved by truck. And Hoffa built the Teamsters into a national empire with iron discipline, sharp negotiation tactics, and strategic ruthlessness. By 1957, after the ousting of then-President Dave Beck on corruption charges, Hoffa became president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. That same year, the union was expelled from the AFL-CIO for alleged mafia infiltration, and that marked a turning point. Hoffa was now the uncontested king of an independent, self-financed, politically dangerous labor force. He wielded power with the confidence of a man who knew the rules and broke them better than anyone else. But Hoffa's power didn't grow in isolation. To finance construction projects, organize national strikes, and reward loyalists, Hoffa needed money. And that money came from the Teamsters' Central States Pension Fund, a multi-billion dollar financial instrument that became a silent currency between Hoffa and organized crime. Mafia families across the country, particularly the Genovese, Bufalino, and Chicago outfit, borrowed from the pension fund to build casinos, hotels, and real estate developments. Las Vegas, in particular, was funded largely with Teamsters' money, funneled through low-interest, unregulated loans that helped create the modern strip. In return, Hoffa received insurance, the kind only the mafia could provide. Protection, strike-breaking, political muscle, and sometimes violence. But Hoffa wasn't a puppet. He kept the mob at arm's length. He viewed them as tools, dangerous tools, yes, but necessary for the ends he believed justified the means. His enemies weren't just corporate bosses or rival unions. They were attorneys general, U.S. presidents, and federal prosecutors. Most notably, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, who declared war on Hoffa during the 1960s. Kennedy formed what became known as the Get Hoffa Squad, a hand-picked team of federal prosecutors and FBI agents whose singular mission was to put Hoffa behind bars. They pursued him across multiple jurisdictions for bribery, jury tampering, and misuse of union funds. In 1967, they succeeded. Hoffa was sentenced to 13 years in prison. But even behind bars, Hoffa didn't fade. He plotted. He kept notes. He wrote letters. He maintained connections. And by 1971, he had an unexpected ally, President Richard Nixon. Hoffa's support of Nixon's 1968 campaign, both in words and likely in Teamsters' contributions, paid off. Nixon commuted Hoffa's sentence in December 1971. But there was a catch, a provision in the pardon that barred Hoffa from engaging in union activity until 1980. Hoffa saw that as a betrayal. He had no intention of staying silent. He immediately began maneuvering to regain control of the Teamsters, threatening the power vacuum that had been filled by Frank Fitzsimmons, a pliable figure seen by many as a mob-friendly proxy. That's when the real tension began. Mafia bosses, including Tony Provenzano and Russell Bufalino, warned Hoffa to back down. But Hoffa was never one to yield. He believed the union was his, and that the only way to clean out corruption was to return to the helm. What he didn't grasp, or perhaps what he underestimated, was how much more dangerous the world had become in his absence. The mafia was no longer simply borrowing from the pension fund. They were controlling it, laundering through it, and protecting those who kept the flow steady. Hoffa's return meant audits, exposure, and retribution. By mid-1975, Hoffa was telling friends he feared for his life, but also that he had a list of names that would burn down the entire network if anything happened to him. Some saw this as paranoia. Others saw it as leverage. Either way, Jimmy Hoffa was playing a high-stakes game, and he was playing it alone. The power he once held had shifted in his absence. The enemies he once controlled now controlled everything. And the allies he once trusted, many of them, were now waiting for the moment he'd overstep. What Hoffa may not have realized was that he had already crossed that line. Chapter 3, Cosa Nostra Connections. I never understood how wide Jimmy Hoffa's shadow really stretched until I started tracing every dollar, dinner meeting, and whispered threat that linked him to America's most dangerous men. Forget rumor. The record shows that without the mafia, Hoffa would never have become the most powerful labor leader in the United States. And without the mafia, he might never have vanished. A partnership forged in money. Hoffa's key to power was the Teamsters' Central States Pension Fund, a multi-billion dollar pool he stewarded like a private bank. From the late 1950s through the early 70s, at least 62% of that fund's commercial loan portfolio went to projects controlled by La Cosa Nostra families, financing Vegas casinos, Chicago high-rises, and Detroit trucking yards. In exchange, mob bosses guaranteed labor peace and muscle at picket lines. Alan Dorfman, the insurance broker who handled most pension fund paperwork, later told a Senate panel that Hoffa could move $100 million overnight with nothing more than a phone call. Prosecutors would call the fund the mob's private ATM. Tony Pro Provenzano, friend turned executioner. Hoffa first met Anthony, Tony Pro Provenzano, in the early 1950s when Provenzano was a rising Genovese family capo running Local 560 in New Jersey. They shared cells at the federal prison in Lewisburg in the 60s and clashed violently over a $200,000 loan Hoffa refused to forgive. According to FBI notes, Provenzano told Hoffa, "I'll pull your guts out," and Hoffa answered, "You'll need a gun." After Hoffa's commutation in 1971, Provenzano issued a standing threat. If Hoffa tried to take back the Teamsters, he was a dead man. Hoffa dismissed it, believing fatally that their old business ties still carried weight. Russell Bufalino, the Quiet Don. Far more discreet was Russell McGee Bufalino, boss of Pennsylvania's Bufalino family. FBI surveillance reports placed Bufalino at more than two dozen pension fund meetings, often seated beside Hoffa. Where Provenzano barked, Bufalino whispered. He cultivated judges, congressmen, and trucking magnates, making him the ideal broker when the mob needed Hoffa either sidelined or silenced. Former Teamsters official Frank Sheeran, whose late-in-life confession we'll examine critically in a moment, said Bufalino pulled every string in 1975, instructing who would pick Hoffa up, where he would be driven, and who would dispose of the body. Even agents who doubt Sheeran's story agree on one point. Bufalino had the authority to greenlight a hit that crossed state lines and family territories. The Detroit Partnership and the Jackalones. Locally, Hoffa's gatekeepers were Detroit capos Anthony and Vito Jackalone. FBI wiretaps show they collected bribes for labor peace and ferried cash from the pension fund to Midwest construction jobs. It was the younger Jackalone who allegedly arranged the July 30, 1975 lunch at Machu's Red Fox, telling Hoffa that Tony Pro would arrive with an olive branch. Hoffa believed it. His mistake was assuming the Jackalones would protect him. In reality, they protected the pension fund's cash flow, and Hoffa's comeback threatened it all. The suspected hit team. The FBI's 1976 Hoffex memorandum lists four primary suspects. Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, Genovese capo. Salvatore Sally Bugs Bergoglio, Provenzano's top enforcer. Gabriel Bergoglio, Sally Bugs' brother, getaway muscle. Thomas Andretta, Provenzano lieutenant. All four were in Detroit in the week of Hoffa's disappearance. Two eyewitnesses placed a maroon Mercury marquee, similar to Gabriel Bergoglio's, near the restaurant that afternoon. Sally Bugs, notorious for garroting victims in daylight, bragged in a New Jersey bar that Hoffa went like a lamb. He was gunned down on Mulberry Street in 1978 before he could be hauled before a grand jury. Frank Sheeran, confession or con. Decades later, former Teamster Frank, the Irishman, Sheeran claimed he drove Hoffa to a Detroit house and shot him twice behind the ear. Journalists Jack Goldsmith and Dan Moldia, along with multiple retired agents, call the account logistically impossible. Sheeran was recorded on an FBI wiretap in Pennsylvania that same day, and no physical evidence ties him to the scene. Still, Sheeran's tale spotlights Bufalino's role. Even skeptics agree Bufalino could have orchestrated any final transport of Hoffa's remains, whether to an acid vat, a landfill, or a crematory. The pension fund pipeline. Between 1960 and 1975, more than $1 billion in Teamster loans flowed into mob-linked resorts, including the Desert Inn, the Stardust, and the Aladdin in Las Vegas. Every dollar earned interest, kicked back as cash envelopes, equity stakes, or political donations. Hoffa's threatened audit would have exposed loan shark rates, forged appraisals, and double-pledged collateral. For the mafia, the exposure risk outweighed the benefit of keeping Hoffa alive. Why silence endured? Provenzano died in prison in 1988, never charged. Bufalino died in 1994, never indicted for the disappearance. The Jackalones took Omerta to the grave. With no body, no murder weapon, and every witness either killed or convicted on unrelated charges, federal prosecutors conceded in 2006 that no further indictments are forthcoming. The pension fund, meanwhile, was placed under stricter federal oversight, decades too late. Closing reflection. By 1975, Hoffa believed history would bend to his will one more time. What he failed to see was that the mafia families he once treated as junior partners had grown into financial giants who no longer needed the man, only his money. When the risk of his return outweighed his usefulness, La Cosa Nostra enforced its cost-benefit calculus the only way it knows, permanent removal. Chapter 4. Nixon's deal with the devil. There's an old rule in politics. If you want to bury a scandal, find someone who already has dirt on their hands. When President Richard Nixon commuted Jimmy Hoffa's prison sentence in December 1971, it wasn't a gesture of mercy. It was a transaction, a calculated political move that unleashed a chain of consequences neither man would live to fully see. Let's be clear, this wasn't an act of generosity. It was a deal, one that would drag the White House into the orbit of organized crime and ignite Hoffa's fatal obsession with reclaiming his power. The Nixon pardon. Hoffa had been serving a 13-year sentence for jury tampering, attempted bribery, and fraud. By 1971, he had served nearly 5 years at the federal penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. That year, with Nixon deep into his first term and struggling with union support, the White House began quietly entertaining clemency requests. The pivotal moment came when Frank Fitzsimmons, Hoffa's hand-picked successor and longtime loyalist, began pouring Teamsters' campaign donations into the Republican Party, a shift from their traditional Democratic allegiance. Internal memos later revealed that the Nixon administration saw an opportunity to trade clemency for union backing in the 1972 election. And it worked. On December 23, 1971, Nixon granted Hoffa a commutation, not a full pardon. The sentence was cut short, but a highly unusual condition was inserted. Hoffa was barred from engaging in any union activity until March 1980, the remainder of his original term. It was a legal muzzle, and Hoffa hated it. The conditions and the betrayal. Why include that clause? According to FBI records and Nixon White House tapes, the restriction came under pressure from mob-linked labor bosses, especially those who had grown comfortable under Fitzsimmons' leadership. Hoffa's return would trigger audits, power struggles, and loss of control over the Teamsters' Central States Pension Fund. And so, the restriction served two purposes. It kept Hoffa out of the way during Nixon's re-election campaign. It protected the financial network the mafia had built around the union. But Hoffa wasn't a man to follow orders, especially from politicians he viewed as manipulators. Almost immediately after his release, he began plotting a comeback. The re-entry strategy. Hoffa's plan was methodical. He began holding private meetings with Teamster officials who remained loyal. He gathered legal teams to challenge the restriction in federal court. He made calls, took interviews, and quietly let it be known that he was coming back. The White House was watching. So was the FBI. So were the men whose livelihoods depended on Hoffa not returning to power. Publicly, he maintained that he respected the law. Privately, he believed Nixon's clause was unconstitutional, an illegal condition attached to a lawful commutation. Hoffa had every intention of fighting it in court, but before he could file a serious challenge, he needed to reclaim his influence. That's when the pressure started. Surveillance and warnings. Declassified FBI reports show that by 1973, agents had resumed 24/7 surveillance of Hoffa, wiretaps, mail monitoring, and undercover observation. They weren't just watching him, they were watching who was watching him. They believed that several high-ranking mob figures, including Anthony Provenzano and Russell Bufalino, had begun informal conversations about neutralizing Hoffa. In a 1974 report to the Justice Department, one field agent wrote, "The intersection of organized labor, organized crime, and executive power presents a critical risk. Should Hoffa attempt to regain control, retaliation will not be political. It will be terminal. In plain terms, if Nixon's restriction didn't keep Hoffa quiet, the mob would. Nixon's silence. The Watergate scandal was exploding by the time Hoffa went missing in July 1975. Nixon had resigned a year earlier, disgraced and cornered, but the ripple effects of his presidency remained. Interestingly, Hoffa's name never appeared in the final Watergate hearings. Not once. Despite the known backroom deals. Despite the Teamsters' illegal campaign donations. Despite Nixon's recorded conversations that hinted at keeping Hoffa in line. Historians speculate this omission was not accidental. If Hoffa were officially tied to Watergate, or worse, if his murder was tied to Nixon's circle, it could have transformed the scandal from political disgrace into a criminal conspiracy implicating union money and mob influence. After the disappearance, after Hoffa vanished, the Nixon pardon came under new scrutiny. Why did the president commute a sentence for a man with such deep mafia connections? Why place such an oddly specific restriction on union activity? Why not include enforcement provisions? The answer, many believe, lies in the balance of power at the time. Nixon needed the Teamsters. The Teamsters needed Hoffa gone. And the mafia needed the pension fund untouched. Everyone got what they wanted. Except Hoffa. Final reflection. Hoffa believed he could outmaneuver the President of the United States, outlast the mafia, and outfight the federal government, all at once. In the end, it was Nixon's pen stroke that set the timer. It gave Hoffa freedom, but not power. It gave the mob time, but not patience. And it gave history a question with no clean answer. Did Jimmy Hoffa walk into a trap engineered by the very system he helped corrupt? Or did he simply miscalculate how many devils were at the table? Chapter 5, The FBI Files. There are over 16,000 pages in the FBI's case file on Jimmy Hoffa. It's known internally as HoffEx, shorthand for Hoffa extortion. What began as a standard missing person case on July 30, 1975, escalated within 48 hours into a full-scale federal investigation involving surveillance teams, informants, forensic specialists, and mafia task forces. It's one of the most expensive and unresolved manhunts in FBI history. And to this day, it remains open. The initial response. Hoffa was reported missing by his wife, Josephine, just after 7 p.m. the day he disappeared. Local law enforcement in Bloomfield Township responded, but within 24 hours, the FBI took lead jurisdiction, citing potential organized crime involvement. The Bureau's first steps were procedural. Lock down the Machu's Red Fox restaurant and its parking lot. Seize Hoffa's maroon 1974 Pontiac Grandville, which was found still parked outside. Interview every employee, customer, and witness present between 1 o'clock and 4 p.m. From the start, the results were confusing. The car was untouched. No broken windows, no signs of forced entry, no trace of struggle. No blood, no fingerprints other than Hoffa's. Keys missing. Interior clean. It looked like he simply got in another car and disappeared. Eyewitness accounts. Two key witnesses emerged early on. Marvin L. Kind, a self-described mob driver and government informant, who claimed to have seen Hoffa enter a late-model Mercury Marquis with three men. A truck driver parked across the street, who saw Hoffa pacing outside the restaurant between 2:30 and 3 p.m., appearing agitated and checking his watch. The most credible timeline now puts Hoffa's last known sighting at 2:45 p.m. By 3:15 p.m., he was gone. Prime suspects in the files. From hundreds of leads, the FBI narrowed its suspects to four men, all associates of Anthony, Tony Pro Provenzano. Salvatore Sally Bugs Bergoglio, enforcer and hitman with a violent track record. Gabriel Bergoglio, Sally's brother, also present in Detroit that week. Thomas Andretta, Provenzano's trusted lieutenant. Charles Chucky O'Brien, Hoffa's longtime associate and surrogate son, who reportedly drove a Mercury Marquis similar to the one Hoffa entered. Although O'Brien denied involvement, forensic testing revealed a single strand of Hoffa's hair in the back seat of the car he drove that day. That hair was rootless, meaning it could have been from a hairbrush, but it raised flags. None of the suspects were ever charged. Why? Because no body was found, and the FBI had no conclusive evidence tying them to the crime. Surveillance failures. Between 1973 and 1975, the FBI had already been conducting active surveillance on the mafia's influence in the Teamsters. Informants had tipped them off that something big was going to happen regarding Hoffa in the summer of 75. Despite that, there were no agents watching Hoffa on July 30th. Post-event, the FBI launched massive wiretap efforts, monitoring over 50 phones across Detroit, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Transcripts show coded conversations between mob figures, with cryptic phrases like "the package has been delivered" and "the room's been cleaned." But without context or confession, the Bureau was stuck in a conspiracy of silence, searches, and false leads. Over the next three decades, the FBI initiated multiple high-profile searches, often based on informant tips. 1975 to 1976. Properties near Detroit, including private homes and garages allegedly used by the Mafia. 1982. A drainage pond near Bloomfield Township was dredged for remains. Nothing found. 2003. A Detroit horse farm was excavated after a mob informant claimed Hoffa was buried under a barn. The dig made national headlines, nothing found. 2013. Soil samples tested in Oakland County after new tips emerged. Again, no trace. 2021. Based on a tip from Dan Moldia, an investigative journalist who'd tracked the case for decades, the FBI searched a former landfill beneath the Pulaski Skyway in Jersey City, New Jersey. The Bureau later confirmed no human remains were recovered. Each dig cost hundreds of thousands in manpower and resources. Each one ended the same way: empty ground, declassified documents, and internal conclusions. In 1976, the FBI compiled a formal summary of all findings, now known as the Hoffex Memo. It concluded, with 95% confidence, that Hoffa was murdered by associates of Anthony Provenzano and Russell Bufalino, most likely on orders to prevent him from regaining control of the Teamsters. But the memo also confirmed, no direct evidence exists tying any one individual to the act. No remains have ever been recovered. The case is unresolved and officially open. In 2006, the Bureau formally stated that they were shifting resources away from Hoffa's case due to lack of new evidence. In plain English, the leads had dried up, the suspects were dead, and the trail had gone cold. Final reflection. The FBI built one of the largest files in American investigative history. They wiretapped mob bosses, they followed pension fund paper trails, they debriefed informants. They knew who had motive. They had names. They had patterns. What they didn't have, and still don't, is a body. No weapon. No witness. No confession. In the world of organized crime, that's called a perfect hit. In the world of justice, it's a case that still haunts. Chapter 6, Burial Grounds and False Graves. It's the question that refuses to die. Where is Jimmy Hoffa buried? Nearly five decades after his disappearance, there is still no confirmed body, no official crime scene, and no verified resting place. But that hasn't stopped hundreds of tips, dozens of digs, and a growing list of theories, each one more bizarre, more desperate, and more public than the last. From Detroit horse farms to New Jersey landfills, from acid vats to stadium end zones, the hunt for Hoffa's remains has become part true crime investigation, part national obsession. This chapter cuts through the myth and focuses solely on the locations, excavations, forensic findings, and official efforts made to answer the question. Where did they put the body? The early theory, cremation. Immediately after Hoffa's disappearance in 1975, one of the FBI's earliest theories was incineration. Detroit had multiple mob-connected sanitation and waste facilities, including one owned by Peter Vitale, an associate of the Giacalone crime family. Federal agents speculated that Hoffa may have been driven to one of these locations, murdered on-site or just before, and his body cremated or destroyed in a high-temperature industrial furnace. The advantage? No remains. No DNA. No trace. But no solid evidence ever emerged. No records, no security logs, no witnesses. Just silence. The horse farm, Milford Township, Michigan. In 2003, acting on information from mobster Frank Sheeran, whose later life confession inspired The Irishman, the FBI searched a horse farm in Milford Township outside Detroit. Sheeran claimed Hoffa was shot inside a house on the property, then buried in a shallow grave behind the barn. The FBI conducted a full-scale dig, ground-penetrating radar, soil analysis, and multiple trenches. Result, nothing. No bones. No blood. No disturbed earth consistent with burial. To date, Sheeran's claim is considered unverified and highly disputed by most agents involved in the case. The Giants Stadium Theory. For years, one of the most repeated myths was that Hoffa was buried in the end zone of Giants Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, poured into the concrete during construction. The theory originated in a 1989 Playboy article and was later repeated on TV shows, podcasts, and in pop culture. It was a sensational image, but completely unsupported. In 2010, the stadium was demolished and forensic teams were given access to the site. No remains were found, no disturbed areas, no inconsistencies in the construction base. It was, as the FBI later noted, the least credible and most publicized false lead in the case. The hidden landfill, Jersey City, New Jersey. In 2021, the FBI received what they described as a credible tip, pointing to a landfill beneath the Pulaski Skyway in Jersey City. The source? Paul Coppola Jr., the son of a mobster who allegedly confessed to helping bury Hoffa in a 55-gallon steel drum beneath layers of concrete and garbage. Journalist Dan Moldia, who had spent 45 years investigating Hoffa's disappearance, brought the tip forward with supporting detail. In November 2021, FBI agents executed a warrant and conducted an extensive search of the site, including core drilling and radar imaging. Result: no evidence of human remains, the FBI announced in July 2022. Still, Moldia insists the Bureau dug in the wrong spot, about 12 feet from where the informant claimed the barrel was placed. To this day, the FBI has not closed the theory, but no further searches have been announced. The drum theories. Multiple mob informants over the decades have repeated some version of the drum theory. That Hoffa was killed, placed in a 55-gallon oil drum, and either dumped in the Atlantic Ocean, crushed inside a Detroit junkyard compactor, or buried in a landfill under a false name and record. In one version, he was frozen, then shipped across state lines in a refrigerated truck. In another, he was melted in acid. All of these theories share one common element: plausibility without proof. The FBI tracked dozens of these leads, truck rentals, warehouse reports, shipping logs. None led to a conclusive burial site. Ground-penetrating radar, GPR, and cadaver dogs. In nearly every major dig, from the horse farm to the Jersey landfill, the FBI has used GPR and cadaver dogs, trained to detect human decomposition gases even decades old. In each case, soil anomalies were identified, but none led to Hoffa. In 2013, a private citizen claimed Hoffa was buried beneath his driveway in Roseville, Michigan. The FBI tested the soil. Nothing. In 2019, cadaver dogs signaled a potential hit in an abandoned Detroit garage. The dig revealed animal bones, not human. Why the body may never be found? Let's consider the cold logic of professional crime. The men suspected of killing Hoffa were career killers, affiliated with a multi-family, interstate criminal network. If they wanted him to vanish, they wouldn't leave evidence behind. And if Bufalino, Provenzano, and the Giacalones all agreed on one thing, it was this. If you kill a man like Hoffa, you don't just hide the body. You erase it. No grave. No funeral. No memory. Final reflection. After nearly 50 years, the most realistic conclusion is also the most haunting. Jimmy Hoffa wasn't buried in a field, or a stadium, or a landfill. He was dismantled by a system he once controlled, erased by a network that understood how to keep power by eliminating risk. All the digs, maps, and whispers won't bring back what was never meant to be found. And maybe that was the point all along. Chapter 7, The Silence Pact. There are murders, and then there are disappearances. But when it comes to Jimmy Hoffa, we are dealing with something much more deliberate. A vanishing sealed not just by a body never found, but by an unbreakable wall of silence that has endured for nearly 50 years. This is the story of that silence. Of how entire criminal networks, corrupt union officials, and even law enforcement insiders managed to bury one of the most high-profile assassinations in U.S. history without a single confirmed witness or confession. We call it Omerta, the mafia code of silence. But in Hoffa's case, it was more than a tradition. It was a pact of power, sealed by fear, reinforced by money, and sustained by time. Why no one talked? To understand why Jimmy Hoffa's killers never spoke, we have to understand the structure of the American Mafia in the 1970s. The people closest to Hoffa's disappearance, Provenzano, Bufalino, the Giacalones, the Bergoglio brothers, were all high-level soldiers or capos in Mafia families that operated under strict rules of secrecy, enforced by death. These rules weren't cultural quirks, they were operational mandates. Talking wasn't betrayal. Talking was suicide. Informants didn't live long, and families who broke rank were marked for generational retribution. Everyone knew the stakes. Everyone knew the code. Even men under indictment, men in prison, men dying of cancer, they all kept quiet. The Justice Department's problem. Federal prosecutors, FBI agents, and state investigators spent decades trying to flip suspects, offering reduced sentences, witness protection, even full immunity. But time after time, those efforts failed. Why? Because in organized crime, the law isn't the highest authority. The law doesn't control your neighborhood, your family, or your burial. The mafia does. And in Hoffa's case, the people with the power to expose the truth had more to lose than gain. Even in death, Hoffa remained a threat, because if someone confessed, it could trigger a RICO chain reaction exposing millions of dollars in embezzled pension funds, real estate fraud, and political bribery. The inner circle stayed quiet. Let's look at the inner circle. Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano died in prison, never spoke a word about Hoffa. Russell Bufalino died in 1994, having avoided all prosecution related to the disappearance. Vito and Anthony Giacalone repeatedly subpoenaed but invoked the Fifth Amendment every time. Salvatore Sally Bugs Bergoglio, assassinated in 1978 on a Manhattan sidewalk, likely to keep him silent. Frank the Irishman Sheeran gave a deathbed confession, widely disputed, never cross-examined. Even Charles Chucky O'Brien, who was once like a son to Hoffa, denied any involvement until his death in 2020, despite forensic evidence linking his vehicle to Hoffa's last known location. None of these men cracked. Not one. Union silence and the financial motive. The Teamsters Union, for its part, had every reason to avoid a reopened investigation. After Hoffa's disappearance, the union leadership under Frank Fitzsimmons, and later Jackie Presser, became deeply entangled with mafia interests. Millions in pension fund loans continued to flow to mob-owned construction, trucking, and hotel projects. The FBI eventually placed the Teamsters' Central States Pension Fund under federal oversight in 1982. But by then, billions had already been misappropriated. If Hoffa's murder had been officially solved and linked to a specific mafia union conspiracy, the legal blowback would have crippled the union and exposed decades of political corruption. So the silence wasn't just criminal. It was institutional. Fear outlived the men. One might think that as the suspects aged or died, the truth would eventually come out. It hasn't. Even second and third generation insiders, sons of mobsters, retired union members, low-level drivers, have largely kept to the same story. I heard a theory, but I never saw anything. Some gave interviews. Some hinted at knowledge. But none produced evidence. None confessed on the record. Why? Because even now, in the 2020s, the fear persists. Whether rational or not, those connected to the case still carry the weight of potential retribution, loss of legacy, or legal exposure. Even journalists like myself, who've spent decades investigating this story, have encountered sources who speak confidently off the record, but never commit to testimony. The silence is no longer just a rule. It's a reflex, the FBI's final realization. In an internal memo from the Detroit FBI office in 2006, a senior agent wrote, "This is no longer a case about who did it. We know who did it. It's a case about who will talk, and the answer, after 31 years, is no one." That statement still holds today. The FBI knows the major players. The forensic trails have been run. The case is a near-perfect murder, executed not just by killers, but by an ecosystem designed to protect them. Chapter 8, Legacy in the Shadows. There are names that vanish with time. And there are names that become bigger in absence than they ever were in life. Jimmy Hoffa belongs to the second category. But what's most disturbing about Hoffa's legacy is that the longer he stays missing, the more powerful the silence around him becomes. He's no longer just a man who vanished. He's become a symbol of corruption unchecked, of justice delayed, and of a system that often protects power before it protects truth. This is not just the story of an unsolved case. It's a mirror reflecting back five decades of silence, strategy, and failure. The man versus the myth. During his lifetime, Jimmy Hoffa was both hero and villain, often in the same breath. To working-class Americans, especially truckers and warehouse men, he was a savior. He fought for fair wages, pensions, and protections no other union could deliver. By the early 1960s, he had secured the National Master Freight Agreement, the first nation-spanning labor contract in U.S. history. He made men middle class who never thought they would be. He put food on tables and shoes on kids. But that came at a cost. To achieve those victories, Hoffa didn't just negotiate with employers. He partnered with organized crime and then tried to outgrow them. He brought the mob into the union's finances, then tried to evict them once he was done using them. He assumed, fatally, that loyalty and power flowed both ways. And when they didn't, he disappeared. How he's remembered. Ask the average American today what they know about Jimmy Hoffa, and most will say, didn't they bury him in a football stadium? Or, he vanished, right? The mob got him. Few mention the labor movement. Fewer still mention the men who walked safer roads because of Hoffa's confrontational bravery in the 1950s and 60s. Instead, his name is shorthand for a punchline, a riddle, a meme. That's the cruelty of historical memory. The farther the truth hides, the easier it is to rewrite. The institutions that failed. Let's talk plainly. Hoffa didn't just fall victim to a mafia hit. He fell victim to a failure of institutions that allowed corruption to thrive. The Teamsters, who welcomed criminal partnerships and turned their back on internal reform. The federal government, which compromised integrity by cutting political deals with men it knew were dirty. The justice system, which despite knowing who likely killed Hoffa, failed to bring any of them to trial. And the public. We turned the mystery into entertainment, movies, theories, books, barstool debates, while forgetting the very real manipulation, fear, and betrayal that defined the final years of this man's life. The lessons left behind. There are three enduring truths that Hoffa's disappearance teaches us. Power without accountability becomes toxic. Hoffa had it. The mob had it. The White House had it. And none were held responsible when it turned violent. Justice delayed becomes permission. The longer the case went unsolved, the stronger the signal to others in power. Silence works. Murder can be clean, and fear keeps history quiet. Memory can be manipulated. Hoffa's story has been repackaged so many times that it's hard to separate fact from fiction. Not because the facts aren't there, but because the truth makes us uncomfortable. Final reflection. Jimmy Hoffa wanted to be remembered as the man who made the American worker powerful. He feared no mob, no politician, no prison. But in the end, the very systems he built turned against him, quietly, brutally, and permanently. He disappeared at 62 years old. His body was never found. No one was charged. And nearly 50 years later, the silence remains unbroken. That silence isn't just about him. It's about all of us, the stories we're willing to ignore, the crimes we never solve, and the uncomfortable truth that sometimes, power protects itself. This was the true crime behind Hoffa's last ride.